Hey, good morning. It's Patricia Murphy. It's Friday. This is Seattle Now. This week, the tech and wine industries were rocked by the failure of Silicon Valley Bank. The state is attempting to bring some equity to the cannabis market by opening up new licenses, and the cherry trees at the Pike Place Market were cut down. But they're going to put in new ones, so it's all good, right? KUOW arts reporter Mike Davis and producer Vaughn Jones are here to break down the week. But first, let's get you caught up. Keep your ORCA card handy. Transit enforcement is still on the table. The Washington State Supreme Court upheld that the practice is constitutional, but they ruled that police wrongfully detained a Snohomish man after he didn't provide proof of fair payment. The justices did not outline the requirements of enforcement. Even so, community transit and Sound Transit leaders have said they'll look closely to ensure their enforcement plan complies with the ruling. There's still time for you to weigh in on the Bell Street waterfront project between First Ave and Elliott Ave. Waterfront Seattle's online open house is open until midnight Sunday. You can check out the plans and design at waterfrontseattle.org. It's your opportunity to weigh in on the pedestrian, biker, greenery, and community needs. Belltown Community Center says so far they've gotten more than 500 responses, including some people concerned about fitting all the ideas into a $3.3 million budget. And UW professor and playwright Nikki Yeboah is taking a close look at CHOP in a new documentary play called 11th and Pine. The work incorporates 29 interviews with community members to tell the story of people who lived, worked, and protested during the summer of 2020. Yeboah says there are few signs and traces of the movement, and she wanted to explore what's left and what changed. Sound Theater Company will stage a public reading through Sunday at the Erickson Theater. Well, 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 if it isn't our old friend Friday. Pull out the capris, people. We are heading towards a spring-like 60 for the next couple of days. This week, Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell was pressed for a plan to revitalize downtown. Pfizer announced it's buying Bothell-based biotech giant Seagen for $43 billion, and Facebook's parent company Meta slashed another 10,000 jobs on its path to efficiency. KUOW arts reporter Mike Davis is here. Mike, really glad you're back.
Thanks for having me.
And KUOW's Vaughn Jones is here. You may know their name and their work from this show. Vaughn, really glad to have you on the other side of the mic.
Thank you, Trish. Dreams do come true.
Well, we just mentioned more layoffs at Meta, but that was a minor chaos compared to what happened to tech when Silicon Valley Bank went down last week. Investors got spooked as SVB tried to solve a cash flow problem, and it all happened very quickly from there. The Fed stepped in to replenish any of the money depositors would have lost, but some of the criticism is that the government stepped in to rescue white investors here. Biden tried to tamp down that narrative by articulating that this wasn't a bailout, that executives at SVB would be fired for this, and the feds were actually protecting customers, not the bank. I am curious what you think about that narrative.
So many of us talked about this. My mom called me and asked me about this. And the thing that bothers me in that type of narrative is the fact that if you had under $250,000 in the bank, your money was fine. Your money was already insured by the feds. You literally had nothing to worry about. Now, if you had over $250,000 in cash in the bank, then yeah, you were in trouble. So when we look around Seattle, for instance, like we had companies here who had more than that in that bank, and they were afraid that they couldn't make payroll. So outside of people that work in the tech industry, outside of people that work for tech startups that banked with this particular bank, no regular people were in trouble. This isn't a you and me crisis.
Vaughn Jones, Mike Davis, coming in hot there.
You know what? I'm going to have to go out on a limb and say I completely agree. That it's just so difficult to envision this being a problem for anybody in my social circles or anybody that I interact with on the day-to-day.
Interesting. Well, no matter where you land on this, anxiety was definitely running high in this town. SVB was the bank of choice for tech startups. And Mike, to your point, many of them, most of them, had far more than $250,000 at risk during this time. People were worried about making payroll. We talked with Paul Roberts from the Seattle Times, who said it was definitely a few wild days. But the most interesting thing to me in this is that this kind of speculative spending is critical to the tech industry, right? These companies need this money to fund growth in the tech industry, to fund the disruption that gets us to the next place. So my question is, how much should we value this risk in this scenario?
I feel like this is less of a risk situation when you look at it. I mean, by their own admission and calculation, Silicon Valley Bank was involved in some way with 44% of tech and health-related startups last year. So it's less about, you know, in my opinion, I guess it's less about, you know, do we need to bankroll the risk? And it's more about how many people, how many banks do we have to bankroll this risk? Where it's like, if 44% of startups are dealing with one singular entity like that, you know, there seems to need to be some diversification there, I suppose.
That was another point that Paul Roberts made, Vaughn. You know, as this bank went down, all these customers are considering what they should be doing with their money now. And there are very few, if any, other banks out there who are versed in this particular kind of investing and market, right? Same goes for the wine industry, apparently. There's a lot of speculation that goes into these businesses, and SVB was the leader for decades in doing this kind of banking.
And I know that what I say now is probably going to run opposite of what I said before, but SVB was important, and they did play an important role in the economy. They went out on a limb and gave loans to startups that they knew wouldn't see profits for years. They also gave those same startups lines of credit. So they gave a lot of new and emerging companies a way to be able to get out here and do business in ways that traditional banks, they're not going to take on that type of risk. So there is something to be said that a bank like this can fail, because for the people who are actually out here trying to do the bootstrap stuff, this is where they go. This is where they bank. So we want innovation. We want that new smartphone to come out. We want the new this, the new that. This is where all of that comes from. So we do need someone who can bankroll new, fresh, and innovative ideas.
Well, speaking of business and money, PCC workers rallied this week for better pay. Q Shamasawant, who showed up to support on the heels of her new workers' movement. Inflation continues to hurt everyone. And Bon, I think when it comes to stores like PCC, it becomes particularly apparent because it is so expensive there. Seattle Times reported that so many PCC workers were facing food insecurity, they set up a food pantry for workers. Everyone is feeling the pinch, but not everyone is capable of absorbing it. So are workers at PCC just another example of a greater truth that everyone's dealing with right now?
I think absolutely. And I would like to say as a side note, as a part owner of PCC, because I paid my co-op fee, the treatment of these employees is very concerning to me. But I do think that PCC workers are another example of this.
Mike, you know, the PCC workers union contract isn't even set to expire until the end of the year, but the workers are getting out there early, asking to enter negotiations now due to staffing cutbacks. It sounds like it could be a good strategy to get out the message, even if PCC doesn't respond right now and open up the talks.
Yeah, it's absolutely a good time to get that message out. And it looks like the statement from PCC says that they're still looking to wait until the summer as planned. That is what it is. But when you look at the workers and everything that they're asking for, it's hard to fathom working in a grocery store and not being able to afford groceries. I remember when I worked at Nike Town, I spent all my money on Nikes. They gave me an import discount and I spent my whole check there consistently. So PCC has no employee discount. I'm looking at Chuvon, part owner. We're seeing a lot of movement in unions throughout the city. I actually filed a story yesterday on the workers at SIF who put in their paperwork to have a union. And, you know, our good friends at the Seattle Times just went on social media yesterday and they're all changing their profile pic and talking about their upcoming union negotiations. And now we have council member Sawant, who's not going to run for reelection because she's about to go out here and start fighting for unions. I think that what we're seeing at PCC is just a microcosm of what we're seeing in our city. Like, this movement, it's growing, and I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
Well, and in the beginning of the pandemic, right, that conversation about workers was primarily centered on the risk that they were taking to continue doing jobs while most of us were sitting at home. But now that that emergency has abated a bit, the conversation has really shifted back to, hey, this was the same as it was before, and it's no longer acceptable now.
I think the way that we describe labor says a lot about our thoughts about it. And I feel like a lot of the terminology that was used for people who work in grocery stores, fast food restaurants, things like that, was previously, before the pandemic, called unskilled labor. Mm. And it has shifted now to essential labor, essential workers. And I think that's a really good way to view it. But the money now has to come with that.
Not all of the views have shifted, which is the part that baffles me. A lot of the people who are going to sit in their home and not even do their grocery shopping, they're going to pull out that app and send someone else to do it, seem to not understand how important the people are that are actually delivering the food, actually doing the shopping, actually stocking those shelves. Like, we have such just a wide gap in our society right now of the haves and the have-nots. But yeah, something's going to give.
Well, and one thing is true right now. The change and the shift in the labor movement is mostly incremental. These are fights going on across the country, but there has been no major shift in the labor movement itself thus far. Moving on now, Washington State's cannabis industry is reopening for new business licenses. Pot sales have been legal in our state for more than a decade, but the industry does not reflect the state's population. Data shows in 2020, 82% of pot shops were majority white owned. Meantime, census data shows that just about 62% of Washington State identifies as white. Given what we know about this country, it is not surprising that this industry is majority white. But it is also an industry that people have a difficult time breaking into. So the state is reopening these applications for licenses with an eye towards equity. 45 new licenses for pot shops are opening up. This is an effort, obviously, to correct an inequity. Vaughn, there was a similar push in Arizona to make this happen. How did it go there?
Arizona is my home state, and it was interesting going back through and doing some research on this and seeing stories with my own byline. I was like, oh, wow, that's really interesting. Much love to KJZZ, the NPR member station in Phoenix. Yeah, I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned here. I think you mentioned that high barrier of entry, and I think that was the number one lesson that could have been learned. It is less expensive here. I think it's $1,500 for this license application. In Arizona, it was $4,000, and there was a lot of rush to make sure that you were opening your business in a timely manner. So there was, you know, zoning law that you had to deal with and finding a property that was suitable to grow and sell. And because of that high barrier of entry, more than 50% of the 1,500 applications in Arizona were bankrolled in some portion by major cannabis industry money or investors. These things could potentially be worth millions of dollars. There was also a controversy in Arizona where there was nothing in the laws that were established that would stop the winners of those licenses from selling them to major companies and just giving the other people the licenses, giving, you know, already established companies the licenses. So I think the intention behind this is good, but you have to be really careful and ask yourself, you know, who am I serving? You know, who is this law going to serve in the long run? And try and keep the major industry money, again, that majority white industry money, from being pervasive in these social equity licenses.
Well, and Mike, the program is designed to prioritize people that have been harmed by the war on drugs. Formerly incarcerated people are going to be considered, those who've lived in areas with high rates of drug convictions, poverty, and unemployment. It doesn't change, though. Some of the things, Vaughn, that you were talking about, but also the fact that the experience of people from these particular groups with the banking industry and the business community is far different than a white experience. How are we going to address that?
Well, that was exactly where I was going to go. You read my mind, Trish. This is Seattle. Man, there's specific groups of people who have a very, very tough time even living in Seattle. Those of us who had homes that are now gone or, you know, being detached from the communities that we grew up in. It's hard enough to come back to Seattle as a resident. Coming back as a business owner, I don't imagine would be very much easier. What I'm curious about, again, I am not an expert, but what is the overhead cost to actually get in? I mean, outside of just $1,500 for the license, I mean, to open up a business in a city as expensive as Seattle, I mean, there's just a lot of capital that's needed, which brings up your point, Trish. How are you going to get the bank loan to make this happen? And when you're talking about people, for example, who were recently incarcerated, we know statistics on how likely they are to be able to engage with banks and get loans. So it's just it feels like there are still barriers in this industry that still need to be addressed. And some of these barriers aren't even in the industry itself. It's in the ancillary stuff around getting this off the ground. So I do commend the state on putting in the effort to try, but there are additional steps that need to be taken for this to actually become real.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, like so many things, it's like, oh, this is a great idea on paper. But what happens beyond this great idea? You can fund the idea, but if you don't fund and support all the ancillary issues that are going to play out, then what are we really doing here? All right. One last thing before we go, you two. The drama over the cherry trees at Pike Place Market settled this week. I guess. The iconic trees were slated to be cut and replaced with elms because they were unhealthy, a move that concerned people who love them and appreciate their history in this city. Again, Mayor Bruce Harrell may take some hits, but this was not going to be one of them. He stepped in and stopped the plan. Not only did he stop it, he doubled the number of cherry trees that the city would plant. Easy win for the mayor, you two, but here's the thing. The trees were still cut down. The original trees were still cut down.
When it comes to looking at these trees, there is a really great in-depth discussion on this on the critically acclaimed Seattle Now podcast from KOW. On last week's episode of Casual Friday, there was a lot of really great conversation around this. I think there is, you know, a cultural impact to the trees that were there. And I think there is acknowledgement of the difficulties of Asian Americans and specifically Japanese Americans in Seattle because of those trees. But I think they were not going to last forever. The UW arborist spoke about, you know, cherry trees need a very specific environment to live for longer than 30 or 40 years. And we were coming up on the end of the lifespan of these trees. And so to put them in, to take them out, it hurts. There's a visual of a chainsaw cutting down a culturally significant item. But at the same time, it really did have to happen at some point and replace them with these other trees. They were going to replace them with a completely different kind of tree.
It was elm.
Yeah, and elm.
Put elms in.
And I think that is probably the biggest step that Harrell made there, because he knew that the trees were going to have to go eventually. But he said, instead of putting in these new elms, we're going to put more cherry trees in there. And I think that was, in a very strange, you know, Lorax-esque situation, one of the best things that Mayor Harrell could have done.
I was unaware of the cultural significance of the cherry tree. And Seattle has a Japanese culture. And yeah, so if those trees are important to them, then they are also important to Mike Davis.
I am feeling very split about this. The reporter in me feels the weight of the PR machine, and it just makes me slightly queasy. And, you know, that's just, we like to stick our fingers and stuff. And it makes me, you know, makes me want to do that. Well, either way, we are unlikely to see the blooms on any cherry trees anytime soon because the cold spring has delayed the peak by at least a couple of weeks. So, hit or miss for some cherry festivals this year. The UW Quad is behind as well, but you can track that one on the UW Cherry Tree Cam. Hope things get blooming soon. And we are going to leave it there. Thanks to my guests, KUOW arts reporter Mike Davis and producer Vaughn Jones. Thanks, you two.
Thank you, Trish. This was the greatest 40 minutes of my life.
Thanks, Trish. Had a great time.
Thanks for listening to Seattle Now. Today's show was produced by Brooklyn Jamerson Flowers. The show is also produced by Caroline Chamberlain Gomez, Claire McGrain, Vaughn Jones, Jenny Cecil Moore, and Brandy Fullwood. Matt Jorgensen does our theme music. Seattle Now and KUOW Public Radio are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Patricia Murphy. See you Monday.